we had a 1,200% increase in sales using TikTok ads.
My name is Linda, and I'm a co-founder of Love & Pebble. We created Beauty Pops, a frozen facial that melts into nourishing skincare.
I started this business with my husband, and we do everything from packing orders, marketing.
Before, it was just me creating videos, but now I have over 2,000 affiliates that are working with us. If we can do it with TikTok ads, you can too.
Want to grow your business fast? Head over to getstarted.tiktok.com/TikTok ads.
At Ritual, we're celebrating all moms this Mother's Day, current and aspiring. So whether you're looking for fertility support, natal choline, or our best-selling clinically backed prenatal, we've got you covered. Find your Ritual. Go to ritual.com/podcast and for a limited time, get 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Based on net sales from industry data, including Nielsen IQ, Stackline, and Numerator, as of Q4 2024 in top 5 products.
Any of us who have ever watched an episode of a legal show on television, from Perry Mason to Law and Order, are very familiar with the idea of the insanity defense, when the accused claims they didn't know right from wrong when they committed the crime they were charged for. They might claim to have been mentally ill for years, or perhaps they just snapped, lost control of themselves, and did something terrible they wouldn't otherwise have done. But in 1981, a young man in Connecticut took the idea of the insanity plea to the next level. He claimed he was innocent of the murder he'd committed. He'd only done it because he was possessed by a demon. And this became the story that inspired the third film in the Conjuring series. Well, the third film featuring the adventures of Ed and Lorraine Warren, anyway. There were a bunch of Annabelle and Nun movies mixed in there, too. Anyway. While the previous two films took the intrepid duo to haunted houses, this was a new kind of horror story for the pair. And while the film takes the demon plot and runs pretty wild with it in the last half of the movie, the first half is loosely based on the real story of the first time that demonic possession was brought up as a defense in a U.S. court. The film begins with Ed and Lorraine Warren, played once again by Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga, at the exorcism of an 8-year-old boy named David Glatzel, although in real life, David was 11. The exorcism is attended by his family, his older sister Debbie, her boyfriend Arnie Johnson, and Father Gordon in Brookfield, Connecticut. As things seem to go awry, Arnie, hoping to save David's life, invites the demon to enter his body instead. Ed witnesses the demon enter Arnie at the same time, and the demon causes Ed to suffer a heart attack because, you know, it could only be a demon that caused it. Not all the red meat, beer, lack of exercise. Yep, gotta be a demon. Anyway, after a hospital stay, Ed learns that Arnie has become, well, like a different person. And after hallucinating a demonic entity attacking him, Arnie murders his landlord and Debbie's boss by stabbing him 22 times. With the support of the Warrens, his case becomes the first American murder trial where demonic possession is claimed as a defense. And then we go off into fantasy land. Although even the allegedly true part of the film has to be taken with a grain of salt, I mean, the Warrens are involved, the rest of the film goes off in a wild direction as the dynamic duo go in search of what caused David to become possessed in the first place. In the hunt, they discover that a witch's totem was placed under the Glatzel home, through which a satanic curse was passed. Luckily, Ed knows a guy named Kastner, played by John Noble, who was great in Fringe. That was one of my favorite TV shows. He played Walter, but that's a different tangent. Anyway, he's kind of wasted in this. Anyway, he's a former priest who has studied the Disciples of the Ram cult, which is not a real thing. He tells them that an occultist intentionally left the totem there, resulting in a curse on the Glatzels and, of course, David's possession. Then, when the Warrens received notice that detectives from Danvers, Massachusetts, found a similar totem in the death of a young woman named Katie Lincoln, who was also stabbed 22 times, they travel there. The totem was found at the home of Katie's friend Jessica, who is missing. Lorraine learns through a vision that Jessica murdered Katie while possessed before jumping to her death, which allows detectives to recover her body. Lorraine also witnesses the occultist attempting to make Arnie kill himself, but stops her from doing so, causing the occultist to become aware of the Warren's presence. Dun, dun, dun. This leads to a totem being placed inside the Warren's house, which causes Ed to almost stab Lorraine before he can be stopped by their assistant, Drew. A witch's totem made me do it. Yeah, that's it. Anyway, an occult book tells them that for the curse to be lifted from Arnie and the Glatzels, and Ed too, I guess, the Satanist's altar has to be destroyed. But when the Warrens start searching for her, they discover that the occultist is actually Kastner's daughter, who he had secretly raised because, well, you know, priests aren't supposed to have kids. Apparently, during father-daughter bonding time, she became fascinated by her father's research into the occult, which convinced her to become a witch. Kastner leads Lorraine into the tunnels underneath the house where the daughter's altar is, but she kills her father, then curses Ed and Arnie, causing Ed to try and kill Lorraine again, and Arnie to try and kill himself. Luckily, though, when Lorraine reminds Ed how much she loves him, he regains his senses and destroys the altar, saving Arnie too. Kastner's daughter is killed by the demon she'd summoned after failing to complete the curse. When it's all over, Ed, of course, places a cup from the witch's altar in his museum, along with Annabelle, the painting of the nun, and all the rest of the junk from the other movies. Arnie, though, was convicted of manslaughter at his trial and goes to prison, although he married Debbie while he was still behind bars. If only real life could be so neatly tied up with a bow. I say that sarcastically, but when the dust settled, the first half of the film was actually considered accurate, based on the reports of some of those involved, including, well, the Warrens, of course, but also Arnie, Debbie, and David's mother, Judy Glatzel, who even told People magazine that her son saw, quote, a man with big black eyes, a thin face with animal features and jagged teeth, pointed ears, horns, and hooves. They would go on to swear that David had truly been possessed by a demon, which had entered Arnie and caused him to murder his landlord and friend. It really happened, they said, and the things portrayed in the film, well, they really happened too, or so they claimed. Others involved, though, were not so sure, as you're just about to find out. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to the latest episode of Season 9, a season we call Based on a True Story. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. And this season, we're bringing you some of the scariest and most unsettling films about ghosts, demons, murder, and mayhem that have ever been shown on the silver screen. But you can't watch any of them and say, it's only a movie. Every episode of this season will offer the true story behind these terrifying films, which are usually even scarier than anything a movie studio can create. This is episode 10 of season 9, The Conjuring Part 3, The Devil Made Me Do It. Two years after Arnie Johnson murdered his landlord, a book by Gerald Brittle called The Devil in Connecticut appeared in bookstores and documented the events that had, by then, gotten the attention of the American public. Published at the height of the so-called Satanic Panic, it managed to cash in on the terror that was being experienced across the country at the time, generated by claims that sickness were everywhere and the devil was wreaking havoc in every community, big and small. The book became a bestseller and generated a lot of publicity for the Warrens, especially because, as clearly stated within its pages, it was an absolutely true story. Just ask author Gerald Brittle, who we're going to hear a little more from later in this episode. In writing the book, most of the firsthand accounts came from Arnie Johnson and Debbie Glatzel, who claimed that Debbie's parents, Carl and Judy, were also adamant in their support of the Warrens' recollection of the events that occurred. According to their story, the paranormal activity began after the Glatzels went to clean up a rental property they'd just acquired. David recalled an old man suddenly appeared, pushing and terrifying him. They initially thought David was using the old man as an excuse to avoid cleaning, but David informed them that the old man had vowed to harm the Glatzels if they moved into the house. Now, if that had been the only encounter with this man, the family would have dismissed the alleged interaction as nonsense. But David claimed he returned, becoming more frightening every time. He said the man appeared as a demonic beast who muttered Latin and threatened to steal his soul. No one else ever saw the man, but the family did claim they heard strange noises coming from the attic. After David began experiencing night terrors, exhibiting strange behavior, and began suffering unexplained scratches and bruises, the family called upon the services of a Catholic priest who attempted to bless the house. It did no good, and the terrifying family came to the conclusion that the house was evil, but they were unable to get out of the lease they'd already signed. David's visions then worsened, still occurring at night, but now in the daytime too. They were so frightening that Judy and Debbie asked Arnie, who was also close with David, to move into the home and help. But his presence did little to stop what was happening to David. So 12 days after David's first sighting of the demonic old man, the Glatzels called on famed demonologists Ed and Lorraine Warren for assistance. The pair witnessed David's strange behavior for themselves, and after Lorraine witnessed a black mist materialize next to David, she knew they were dealing with a malevolent presence. Debbie and her mother told the Warrens they'd see David being beaten and choked by invisible hands and that red marks had appeared on his neck that looked like fingers. David had started to growl, hiss, speak in otherworldly voices, and recite passages from the Bible. They also stated that a family member had to remain awake each night with David as his body spasmed and convulsed. The Warrens believed that David was suffering from multiple possessions, and this began a series of what they called lesser exorcisms, which really just means that Ed was in charge and the church had nothing to do with them. Anyway, during these exorcisms, Lorraine later claimed that David levitated, ceased breathing for a time, and even demonstrated the supernatural ability of precognition, describing a murder that Arnie would soon commit. According to Lorraine, David made numerous references to murder and stabbings. She later said in an interview, quote, "We were sitting on a powder keg." In October 1980, the Warrens contacted the local police to warn them that the situation was becoming dangerous. Then, according to eyewitness testimony, during another exorcism, Arnie coerced one of the demons, supposedly within David, to leave the boy and possess him instead. Arnie later claimed he was viciously attacked by this demon, which allegedly took control of his car and forced it to crash into a tree. Arnie wasn't hurt, but he did return to the Glatzel home to examine an old well that the demon was supposed to be lurking in on the property. It was there, and after making eye contact with it, which the Warrens claimed they told him not to do, Arnie became possessed. But this didn't cure David's demon problems. In fact, his condition worsened again. Arnie and Debbie, still living at the Glatzel home, decided it was time to move. Debbie was hired by Alan Bono, who recently moved to town, and he hired her as a dog groomer, and the couple began renting an apartment above the business. Alan was now Debbie's employer and the couple's landlord. Meanwhile, there was a marked change in Arnie. Debbie told People magazine that Arnie would go into a trance and would growl and say he saw the beast. And she said, quote, later he would have no memory of it. It was just like David. The day of the murder itself, February 16, 1981, was unremarkable, according to Debbie, aside from the fact that Arnie had called in sick to his job at Wright Tree Service that morning. Around noon, Alan took Debbie, Arnie, Arnie's sisters, who were 15-year-old Wanda and 13-year-old Janice, and Debbie's 9-year-old cousin Mary out for lunch, where he drank quite a bit of wine. After a further uneventful afternoon, Debbie took the girls for pizza in the evening, only to arrive back to the dog grooming business to find that Alan was drunk and agitated. Debbie decided it would be a good idea to leave with the girls again, but before she could, Alan grabbed her cousin Mary and wouldn't let her go. As Debbie went to get her from him, Arnie returned, and that's when tensions went from simmering to the boiling point in just a matter of seconds. Two of the girls ran for the car as Debbie tried to calm things down. Arnie's sister Wanda was holding on to Arnie, who she later said was like a stone. Quote, I couldn't budge him. Wanda heard her brother growling like an animal, and then she said she saw something shiny flash in the air, and then everything just stopped. When it was over, Arnie walked into the woods staring straight ahead, and Alan just stood there, punching his fist into his palm. He continued to stand there for a long moment and then just fell on his face and lay there on the floor. Not far from him was the knife with the 5-inch blade that Arnie always carried in his pocket. Alan died from what doctors said were, quote, 4 or 5 tremendous wounds, and Arnie was arrested about 2 miles from the scene of the murder. Sergeant Gordon Fairchild of the Brookfield Police Department was one of the arresting officers, and he said that Arnie told him he didn't mean to hurt anyone and couldn't remember anything. When Arnie was informed at the police station that Alan had died, Sergeant Fairchild said that Arnie became incoherent and then fell asleep for 20 to 25 minutes. Even though this was the first murder that had ever occurred in Brookfield, Connecticut, Police Chief John Anderson deemed it, quote, not an unusual crime. Somebody got angry, an argument resulted. But that wasn't how the Warrens saw it. The day after the killing, Lorraine informed the Brookfield police that Arnie was possessed when the crime was committed, and they were willing to help with his defense. The inevitable media blitz followed, fueled by the Warrens, whose agents promised that lectures, a book, and a movie detailing the gruesome case were in the works. Martin Minella, Arnie's lawyer, received calls from all over the world about what was being called the, quote, demon murder trial. Minella even traveled to England to meet with lawyers who had been involved in 2 similar cases, although neither of those went to trial. He planned to bring in exorcism specialists from Europe and threatened to subpoena the priests who were involved in the case if they didn't cooperate with the defense, but the case never went that far. The trial began in Connecticut's Superior Court in Danbury on October 28, 1981. Minella attempted to submit a plea of not guilty due to demonic possession, but the presiding judge, Robert Callahan, promptly rejected this defense. Even in the satanic panic climate in America at the time, Judge Callahan stated that no such defense could ever exist in a court of law due to a lack of evidence and that it would be irrelevant and unscientific to allow testimony about it. The defense then essentially punted and implied that Arnie had acted in self-defense, and maybe not. But after deliberating for 15 hours over the next 3 days, Arnie was found guilty of first-degree manslaughter on November 24, 1981. He was sentenced to spend 10 to 20 years in prison, though he only served 5, getting out for good behavior in January 1986. Lorraine Warren would always defend her work with the Glatzel family, claiming that 6 priests were involved in the incident and agreed at the time that David was possessed and that the supernatural events described were real. Although the names of those priests and any independent verification of this claim was never provided. Ed Warren added in one interview, quote, possession doesn't last 24 hours a day. It comes quickly and leaves quickly. Arnie understands what happened to him. He now knows if something happens, how to ward it off, and he won't be stupid enough to take on the devil again. Ed, however, would continue to be that stupid for the rest of his life, however. As for Arnie, he married Debbie Glatzel while he was in prison in January 1984. She went on to not only back the Warrens' version of events, but was also involved in the marketing for the movie, recalling the traumatic events that inspired the film. Sadly, though, she passed away from cancer shortly before the movie's release in May 2021. Arnie, Debbie, and Judy Glatzel maintain that the events that were just described really happened in Connecticut in 1981. But you might be wondering about the rest of the people who were involved in the story. That is, it turns out, a much different version of events. In 1983, there were two more developments in what became known as the Devil Made Me Do It case. The first was the production of a film called The Demon Murder Case, a made-for-TV film from NBC that starred a busload of reliable television faces from the early 80s, like Eddie Albert, Cloris Leachman, Richard Masser, Joyce Van Patten, and it starred Andy Griffith and, wait for it, Kevin Bacon as the character based on Arnie Johnson. It was also, by the way, produced by Dick Clark from American Bandstand. The film is about what you'd expect from a made-for-TV movie in 1983, but it's not terrible, probably because the Warrens' role is downplayed quite a bit. Plus, Andy Griffith. I mean, as the Ed Warren character, it's Andy Griffith. I mean, that's better than Patrick Wilson. I mean, talk about the good guy. Anyway, the Warrens had nothing to do with the film, which I'm sure they hated, but they were directly involved in the book that came out that same year, Gerald Brittle's The Devil in Connecticut. The Glatzel family was paid $2,000 by the publisher for their assistance with the book, and that should have been the end of the story. The book came and went and became just another occult paperback of the 80s. But then, in 2006, the book was reprinted. And that's when the legal trouble started. As most listeners probably agree, legal problems can be scarier than demons. Since Ed Warren had passed away in 2006, David Glatzel and his brother Carl Jr. sued Lorraine, Random House, and author Gerald Brittle, saying that it violated their right to privacy, was libelous, and that it intentionally caused emotional distress to the family. They claim that the possession story was a hoax concocted by the Warrens to exploit the family and David's mental illness. Carl also stated that the book presented him as a villain because he didn't believe in the supernatural claims. He asserted that the Warrens told him that the story would make his family millionaires and would help get Arnie Johnson out of jail. But both Lorraine and Gerald Brittle denied the claims of David and Carl. Brittle said that he wrote the book because the family wanted the story to be told and that he had recorded interviews with the Glatzels and that they signed off on the book as accurate before it went into print. Carl Glatzel Sr., though, their father, denied he ever told Brittle that he believed his son was possessed. Well, Carl Jr. was adamant when he was interviewed by the press about the lawsuit. He said, quote, "My brother was never possessed. He, along with my family, was manipulated and exploited, something the Warrens were very good at. And along with their author, Gerald Brittle, they concocted a phony story about demons in an attempt to get rich and famous at our expense. And we have the evidence to prove it." While the defendants continued to deny David and Carl's claims, the lawsuit was eventually settled out of court on February 16, 2012, exactly 31 years to the day of the death of Alan Bono. But this wasn't the last time we'll hear from Gerald Brittle, and next time it involved the film series that began in 2013. He wasn't a defendant this time. He was the one who filed the lawsuit. Well, maybe, because this whole thing turned into a huge mess. In 2016, after Warner Brothers and New Line Cinema had released a handful of the Conjuring films, Brittle sued them for copyright infringement. In addition to The Devil in Connecticut, he had also written a book called The Demonologist about the Warrens, which included stories on which the studio had based their films. According to The Hollywood Reporter, Brittle claimed that he had exclusive rights to make film options based on the cases discussed in his book. The lawsuit maintained that Brittle had a contract with the Warrens that dated back to 1978, and there was a no-compete clause in it that was, according to him, still in effect. Because of this, he claimed that Warner Brothers, New Line Pictures, and even director James Wan were not supposed to make The Conjuring or any of its subsequent sequels or spinoffs. Lorraine Warren had violated the exclusive agreement that she had with Brittle when she gave the studio and production company the right to use the, quote, Warren case files, which the movies were based on. The lawsuit also expressed disbelief that Warner Brothers, which had a large number of lawyers who specialized in intellectual property rights deals, would not have found Brittle's book or the deals related to it. Brittle maintained that New Line explicitly told the screenwriters not to read The Demonologist, presumably because the studio knew it didn't have the rights to the book. The bad news for New Line is that many of those involved with the film did admit to reading the book and publicly announced it. 2 years before the film hit theaters, James Wan wrote, quote, I watch and read a lot of scary stories, but The Demonologist, a true life account of Ed and Lorraine Warren, is the scariest book I've read. Actress Vera Farmiga, who played Lorraine Warren in the film, said, quote, my research relied heavily on The Demonologist. It scared the daylights out of me. Profoundly. Oops. Prior to the release of The Conjuring 2 in 2016, Warner Brothers was sent a cease and desist letter, which was ignored. Their claim was that the movies are based on historical facts and actual events that occurred in the lives of Ed and Lorraine Warren, so those events could not be copyrighted. And that was where things got a little sticky. According to Brittle, the Warrens lied constantly when they told their stories to him for the book. He said that he believed in the couple at the time he wrote the book, but later came to realize he'd been duped. And he was not the first writer to claim the Warrens extravagantly embellished their stories. Ray Garton, a horror writer who penned the Warrens' version of events about the case that we'll be featuring in our next episode, said that when he found the stories told to him by the family involved to lack credibility, Ed Warren just dismissed his concerns. Ed told him, quote, they're crazy. All the people who come to us are crazy. That's why they come to us. Just use what you can and make the rest up. You write scary books, right? Well, make it up and make it scary. That's why we hired you. Well, Garton added, quote, to the best of my knowledge, the Catholic Church has absolutely nothing to do with the Warrens in any official way, and there are questions about the legitimacy of the priests who work with them. Since writing the book, I have learned a lot that leaves no doubt in my mind about the fraudulence of the Warrens. Not that I had much doubt anyway. I've talked to other writers who've been hired to write books for the Warrens, always horror writers like myself, and their experiences with the Warrens have been almost identical to my own. And that, it turned out, was the heart of the legal issue in Brittle's case. If the Warren case files were actual historic fact, then Brittle had no case. True events in history are not protected by copyright laws. However, if the stories were made up, in whole or in part, and that's what went into Brittle's book, then The Demonologist was essentially a work of fiction. If a judge decided that the book was fictional, then Warner Brothers might have a big problem on its hands, since Brittle was suing them for $900 million. But it never came to that. In December 2017, Warner Brothers and New Line settled the lawsuit by saying that the case had been dismissed because Brittle had announced that filing the lawsuit was a mistake and that the studio and production company had done nothing wrong.
It seemed to be a pretty abrupt about-face, especially after Brittle claimed that he wasn't in control of his own lawsuit. He claimed that Conjuring producer Tony DeRosa Grund, who was in the middle of his own legal battle with Warners, was controlling the litigation from the start, hiring lawyers, funding the legal issues that happened, drafting complaints, responding to discovery, and instructing attorneys not to produce documents. But DeRosa Grund denied the claims. He said that his production company, Evergreen, was contractually obligated to provide legal financing and services to Brittle for his personal litigation against New Line because Evergreen had optioned the author's life rights in 2015. He also claimed that the Warners and New Line's campaign was retribution against him because he was a whistleblower who revealed allegations about Ed Warren that the studio didn't want to know about it. Coincidentally, or was it, the announcement that Brittle's lawsuit had been dropped was announced by Warner Brothers and New Line on the same day that The Hollywood Reporter published a disturbing story about Ed and Lorraine Warren, which claimed they were not the couple that was being portrayed on screen. Of course, most of us know this already, but according to the unsettling allegations, it's possible that even the simple depiction of the Warrens as a devoted and religious couple might have stretched the truth past the breaking point. According to these allegations, in the early 1960s, Ed Warren initiated a relationship with an underage girl with Lorraine's knowledge. In her 70s, when the story came out, Judith Penny stated in a sworn declaration that she lived in the Warren's house as Ed's lover for 4 decades. Ed was in his mid-30s when he allegedly met Judith, who was then 15 years old. Having not yet gained enough fame as a self-taught demonologist to pay the bills, Ed was working as a city bus driver in Monroe, Connecticut. Judith was a student at Central High School in the nearby town of Bridgeport who rode the bus. The two began a, quote, amorous relationship, Judith said in a legal statement in November 2014. According to that document, as well as 2014 interviews with Judith, by 1963, she had moved into the Warrens' home. For the next 40 years, she said she had a sexual relationship with Ed with Lorraine's knowledge. At first, Penny stayed in a bedroom directly opposite the one occupied by the married couple, but eventually she moved into an apartment built for her above the home. Even in 1963, a teenage girl didn't move in with a married man without attracting attention. That year, Judith was arrested after someone reported her relationship with Ed to the local police. According to her 2014 statement, she spent a night behind bars in Bridgeport while police tried to persuade her to sign a statement admitting to the affair. After she refused to cooperate, she was ordered by the court to report to a delinquent youth office for the next month. According to Judith's account, Ed picked her up from school every week and drove her to the mandated meetings. Judith claimed Ed told her many times that she was, quote, the love of his life. The Warrens, according to her, presented her at different times as a niece or a poor girl whom they had taken in out of charity. In May 1978, in her 30s, Judith claimed she became pregnant with Ed's child and that Lorraine persuaded her to have an abortion because the birth of a child could become public and any scandal could ruin the Warrens' business. In her statement, Judith recalled, quote, they wanted me to tell everyone that someone had come into my apartment and raped me and I wouldn't do that. I was so scared. I didn't know what to do, but I had an abortion. The night they picked me up from the hospital after having it, they went out and lectured and left me alone. Judith also claimed Ed was sometimes abusive to Lorraine. Early on, she said she witnessed him backhand his wife so hard she lost consciousness. She added, quote, sometimes Ed would actually have to slap her across the face to shut her up. Some nights, I thought they were going to kill each other. She also said she helped Ed maintain his reputation as a ghost hunter. He claimed to have captured the White Lady, a ghost who supposedly haunts Union Cemetery in Easton, Connecticut, on tape in the summer of 1990, after camping out in the graveyard for a week.
Ed wanted to make a video that would show what the white lady would look like if she were spotted, so Judith put on a white sheet so he could capture the so-called ghost on film. However, an attorney for Lorraine told The Hollywood Reporter that Judy and Tony Spira, the daughter and son-in-law of the Warrens, never saw any of the alleged conduct during the decades they spent with Ed, Lorraine, and Judy. According to the lawyer, quote, "The Warrens opened their home to Miss Penny when she was 18 and had nowhere else to live following a childhood of neglect. During much of their career, Ed and Lorraine were on the road working on cases and giving lectures, and Miss Penny lived at and watched their house." They also said that Judith had a long-term boyfriend for much of that time, who she eventually married, and the couple spent holidays with their family. The Spiras believed that Judith was now being manipulated. But Lorraine seems to have been intent on preventing any sordid aspects of her story from being portrayed on screen. Her deal with New Line for the Conjuring films included some unusual restrictions that included that the films couldn't show her or her husband engaging in crimes, including sex with minors, child pornography, prostitution, or sexual assault. Neither the husband nor wife could be depicted as participating in an extramarital sexual relationship. Well, Judith Penny never sold her story to the media. It only surfaced as part of the legal fight over the films, which started with Gerald Brittle's lawsuit. The explosive allegations were included in an October 2015 letter to New Line with threats to include them in litigation unless the studio agreed to a settlement. The proposed deal suggested terms to resolve not only Brittle's issues with the studio, but also those of Tony DeRosa Grund's issues and Judith's, though she was not part of any settlement discussions. Well, the settlement didn't happen, and the explicit allegations were not included in any of the litigation against the studio. But buried in a 355-page lawsuit that Brittle filed was a claim that Judith was ready to testify about the false nature of the family dynamic in the films. The lawsuit said that Judith would, quote, "disclose the absolute charade of this family dynamic as told by the Warrens and as depicted as fact in all of the defendants' movies. The true family dynamic was known at the highest executive levels of both New Line and Time Warner." But who knows if Judith would have really gone through with exposing the Warrens. She was in her 70s when all this came out, and although she never received a cent from the Conjuring movies and had no love for Lorraine, she still had fond feelings for Ed. Though their relationship ended in 2003 and she subsequently married, she remained friendly with Ed until his death in 2006. She was still pondering her past in a 2014 interview and wondering about Lorraine's role as well as her own. She said, quote, "As I'm older now, I can't even fathom why Lorraine let me stay there. Lots of times I think, why did I do this? Why did I screw up my life like this? Sometimes I get angry thinking about it, about how so much was taken away from me." Judith was angry and blamed herself, which was exactly what a predator and abuser would want her to do. Obviously, there's no way I can know if these stories are true, but there is a lot of evidence that implies something was going on that's a far cry from the behavior of the characters depicted in the series. But as I've always maintained, those characters are just that, characters, not the people from real life. And as far as films go, even if the allegations are true, legal experts say that Warner's and New Line didn't necessarily do anything wrong by allowing so heavily a fictionalized portrayal of the Warrens' relationship. At the end of each film, Warner's has a standard disclaimer that reads, quote, "Dialogue and certain events and characters contained in the film were created for the purposes of dramatization." An attorney named Lincoln Banlow, who specializes in legal clearance for productions, was quoted in The Hollywood Reporter as saying, quote, "I do think the public understands that based on means that some liberties with storytelling have been taken. It's a less enjoyable film if the ghost hunters are a bunch of assholes no one likes. You have to have your protagonists be likable." He added that because these films are ghost stories and not strictly historical, audiences are even more likely to expect some fictionalization. Quote, There's a giant sense of take some of this with a big grain of salt to this whole project. And that says everything you need to know about anything connected to Ed and Lorraine Warren and their place in the world of the paranormal. Take it with a big grain of salt. Thanks again for listening to American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming right up after these messages from our sponsors.
When Troy and I started this podcast, it seemed like we had to figure it out all on our own. Scripts, setup, recording schedule, logos. I mean, seriously, you've heard all the old seasons. It was super overwhelming, and every day seemed to introduce a new decision that needed an answer. When you're starting off with something new, it seems like your to-do list keeps growing every day with new tasks, and that list can easily begin to overrun your life and maybe even frustrate your podcast co-host. Finding the right tool that not only helps you out, but simplifies everything can be such a game changer. For millions of businesses, that tool is Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to brands just getting started. In fact, Shopify is the tool I use to build the American Hauntings clothing store. Get started with your own design studio. With hundreds of ready-to-use templates, Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store to match your brand's style. Accelerate your content creation. Shopify is packed with helpful AI tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography. Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise at everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and beyond. If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. Troy, can I get that that old school cash register? Yeah. Turn your big business ideas into with Shopify on your side. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. One more time, that's shopify.com/hauntings. Okay, Troy, yeah, can you give me the, can you stop? Okay, no, just give me the cash.
At Ritual, we're celebrating all moms this Mother's Day, current and aspiring. So whether you're looking for fertility support, natal choline, or our best-selling clinically backed prenatal, we've got you covered. Find your Ritual. Go to ritual.com/podcast, and for a limited time, get 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Based on net sales from industry data, including Nielsen IQ, Stackline, and Numerator, as of Q4 2024 in top 5 products.
Hey! You okay there?
Jesus.
I think I hurt someone.
This is Ed Warren, here with Lorraine. All right, let's get started.
Residents of Brookfield were shocked this afternoon by the broad daylight murder of Bruno Sauls.
The court accepts the existence of God every time a witness swears to tell the truth. I think it's about time they accept the existence of the devil.
Whatever is going on, whatever happened that day, that was not Arnie.
It's a witch's totem. We think your family was cursed. And that connection's still broken.
I'm only interested in reality.
But I can see things that your people can't.
Something terrible happened here.
Master Satan is not an adversary to be taken lightly.
She's doing it again. She's reaching out to the darkness.
Lorraine, you need to come back. Is saving him worth everything you have? Because that's what it may very well cost.
Lorraine!
Yeah, I might have sounded like I was coming from another room.
I'm glad I caught it.
Ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we're back with the American Hauntings podcast, the postmortem after the episode, where we dissect this week's show. My name is Troy Taylor, and I'm the guy who narrates and writes the shows. And across from me is the guy who really wishes I would stop talking about the Warrens, my friend, producer, sidekick, and co-host, Cody Beck.
You know, I finally started to feel it a little bit today with this episode. Going through all the legal issues.
I know.
Which was necessary.
It was necessary. That was the problem. I had hesitated. I'd gone back and forth. Do I include this stuff? And then
I got to
the point where I'm like, okay, I think it's time, because there's going to be more come up in our next episode too. Not so much the legal stuff, but some of the stuff from people who did writing for them. So yeah. Anyway, but I felt like it was necessary this time.
Yeah,
so
it helped provide more context for your frustrations and just about them as people in general.
Yes, and that's been one of the reasons and one of the problems I've had with them for quite some time since I'd first heard about all this. And it was like, what do I do with this?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I felt like it's public information if you look for it, but you got to really look for it because it ain't real easy to find. Which, you know, I can understand the studio's reasoning for keeping that not necessarily easy to find. But, you know, on the other hand, I think that we have already kind of stressed the idea that the characters in the films are very different from the real life people. And that's pretty normal, you know, with a lot of films. But in this particular case, it's very necessary to make that differentiation. So anyway.
Yeah. A lot of things made more sense. And I also don't blame them for burying that stuff, but I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves.
Oh, no, I know. We're already jumping ahead because you wanted me to talk about what's coming up. So I'm going to talk about what we got coming up in May, or what's left of what we've got coming up in May, because a lot of it is already filled up. But May 17th, new presentation that I'm doing, maybe not new for everyone who listens to the podcast because they got an entire season of Haunted Hollywood, but I'm going to be bringing it to people in a more visual kind of way. So I'm going to be doing a Haunted Hollywood dinner at the American Oddities Museum. And then the week after that, on the 24th, I'll be doing the Gangs of Southern Illinois, which is always a people pleaser, at least in our area. And then on the 31st, Great River Hauntings tour. That's the all you can eat fried chicken at Pier Marquette Lodge, which is my favorite tour. We also have our tours in Alton, which actually started a couple weeks ago, but they'll be running in May, and our Springfield tours kick off this weekend. That's Illinois. Our Decatur, Illinois tours will kick off at the end of May as well. And then, of course, aside from that, the big deal is the Haunted America Conference.
Yes.
Which we've already talked about. I will not belabor it too much today, but we are getting to the point where soon I will be talking about deadlines. Last chance to order one of the souvenir shirts. Last chance to, you know, get in on the discount rate on the hotel, because then it will not be available anymore. So time is now. If you're planning on signing up, get on it. We are still at Lewis and Clark College, but we will be in a new, larger building coming up this year with a very different kind of vendor area, which is going to be fun. And so we're really looking forward to it, and we hope to see you guys there. Cody will be there at his table talking about ghosts and getting your ghost stories and everything else that he wants to do while he's there. So anyway, and of course I'll be around as well. So anyway, check it out. Ghostconference.net. If you're interested in signing up for the conference, and really, why wouldn't you be? And if you're interested in any of the events we've got coming up, the American Oddities Museum or the tours, check us out at dinnerandspirits.com.
So, sweet. Yeah. Sweet. Yeah. I'm excited. Can't wait. Comes faster every not
which
every
I know, year. Man. It does, though. It just, it does, all of a sudden it's here. I feel like tickets just went on sale, you know, and it's already here. But
yeah. Well, I want to give us a quick shout out to our new Patreon subscribers. So thank you very much for supporting the show. To Elena, Lisa, Lil Red 48, Amy, and Michael. So thank you very much for supporting the show. And if you are a Patreon member and you've checked out, I did something fun the other day where I watched Troy appeared on a show called History's Greatest Mysteries, an episode, The Death of Dillinger.
With my friend Lawrence Fishburne, I did not meet while I was there.
Damn it.
Stop asking me. No, he wasn't there. In fact, I was telling the crew that people keep asking me that, and they were like, yeah, we actually haven't met him, and this is our sixth season of doing the show.
Wow.
So, yeah, you know, he comes in, does his thing. You know, it's so
that just destroys like half the jokes I had ready for today. No,
yeah, see, I know, right?
He had to get out ahead of it. But so I watched the episode and did some real-time reaction. You can see a video of me watching it. You can, to be clear, you cannot see the video footage of the actual episode, so you'll have to check that out. I got it on Amazon Prime. You can find it on History Channel, different places.
Yeah.
But if you watch
Discovery
that,
Plus.
Yeah, if you watch that stuff, let me know. I had a good time. It was cool to see Troy on something I hadn't seen you on before.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a fun. It turned out pretty good. I was pleased with, I mean, I've been plugging it. I hadn't even seen it yet, but I was glad to see that it turned out well.
Yeah, it was great. We have a listener review that I'd like to shout out. So thank you very much for the review on iTunes. This one comes to us from Ashy Cole, and it's titled Awesome Podcast. As I've been listening to this podcast since the beginning, and it's one of my favorites. Troy balances the history, hauntings, and legends behind each story while also being respectful of the real people behind the stories. I enjoy the banter between Troy and Cody, especially after a more morbid story. Keep up the great work. So thank you very much. And yeah, it is ironic about I guess being respectful. I think you are we're respectful.
Oh
of
no,
Lawrence.
Well yeah, well, I think of who?
Of the I would say the Warrens.
No, I'm not respectful of the Warrens. I'm respectful of the other people that
the real
were
people.
Taken in by them, you know. So
well now we're gonna talk about Troy later. Was this the real Warrens? Are we getting a watered down version of
I know, right?
But yeah, but I'll dive into that. okay, are we ready to talk about this episode?
Sure. Yeah, we could do that. But I do want to mention before we do, though, since you just had that review.
Oh, yeah.
If you do leave a review, and we'll try to read at least one of them during each postmortem episode. If we read yours, we will send you some cool merch in the mail. So if you hear your review pop up, text me your address on the hotline. Not everybody has, and that's cool. They don't have to. But use the hotline. It's 217-791-7859. Make sure that I've got your address, and I'll send you something cool for free in the mail. I do have one that's pending that is going out. Rick, sorry. Things got a little carried away with me, but it is on its way this week, so you will have something coming. Everybody else should have theirs that we've done so far. Anyway, all right, now we can talk about it. I just want to make sure I got that in there.
Yep. So. No, absolutely.
We didn't forget.
Good call. I would say out of the Conjuring movies, I think this one has my favorite opening scene. I really, really enjoyed it.
I know. Actually, I like this movie.
I know.
You. Yeah. This is probably, I mean, I like the first one really well because it was something different. And I like the cast and the cast on this one is, I don't know most of these people except for the Warrens for the most part. Well, and John Noble, of course, but I do like the movie and I do like the opening too. I think it was good. So yeah, this is a good one.
Yeah. I did like when a priest gets hit in the head with the plate And Ed's thing is like, he's like, where's the first aid kit? I'm like, Ed, okay, first off, maybe we should have prepared for that. And second,
yeah, right.
This is a little tiny, like, dessert plate, you know?
Uh-huh.
And don't get me wrong, that would hurt. And
I'm sure it hurt.
It seemed like there were more pressing.
Or would hurt if it was real.
Yes. There were more pressing matters at the time, like, you know, holding this child down and dodging all the other things that were flying everywhere.
Exactly. Since he's levitating over the kitchen table, you know, or dining room table, whatever it was. But
yeah, and you can tell with this one, I mean, obviously they had a bigger budget, and I didn't even bother to look it up because I just know that they did, mostly because the special effects and the contortionist stuff that the child's doing.
Much better. Yeah, that was an actual contortionist.
Yes.
I had read some stuff about the making of the film, and you know, and like I said, the first half of the movie, or at least the first section of the movie, you know, the family would always say, I mean, I'm going to doubt anything they're involved in.
Yeah.
So period. But the family, well, some members of the family said that that's how it actually happened. It's just that then things kind of skew off into, you know, fantasy world. You know, but still, the first half of it is pretty intense. All the stuff with the murders and stuff. And, you know, even when I watched we'll get into this, but I watched the alternate film made of this with Kevin Bacon and Andy Griffith. And even that stuck closer to the actual story than this did, because they didn't, I guess, have the need to wander off into, you know, demons and defrocked priests and the disciples of the Ram and all this.
Right.
You know, but I mean, which makes for a good movie. It makes for a fun horror film. But on the other hand, you know, if you're looking for really based on a true story, that's where kind of things wandered off the garden path.
So. Yeah. Well, and once you started talking about that, you said Kevin Bacon is Arnie and Andy Griffith is Ed Warren. I was like, oh, are you kidding me?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You can find it. It's on YouTube.
Yeah.
I mean, you can watch the thing, man. Because as soon as I found out there was another movie, which I didn't even know about. But, you know, it makes me think 1982 or 3, whenever that came out, I had to have watched it.
Yeah, you'd think.
I just don't remember it. And I don't remember anything about it. But, you know, I know we're getting ahead of ourselves. But it was still interesting. So it was an interesting movie.
No, I love it. It made me think if mom were still alive, I'd be like, Mom, I got this movie, Andy Griffith, Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
We got to check it
Cannot
out.
Cannot go wrong.
Yeah. You just see what you said. I like the part where you talk about the Warrens believe that David was suffering from multiple possessions. And this began a series of what they called lesser exorcisms.
Yeah.
Really just meant Ed was doing whatever he wanted to do.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much how it went. You know, and again, there's I have a lot of questions about whether or not the real actual Catholic Church was involved with these people. And according to, you know, some of the people who worked with them writing the book, they said they had no connection that whatsoever, except to like a few like off-brand priests, you know. So I don't know. But yeah, that's lesser exorcisms. So.
Right. And something you mentioned too earlier, you said, you know, luckily Ed knows a guy named Castor, played by John Noble. He said he was great in Fringe, but it's wasted here.
Yeah, it's almost kind of like, dude, you are slumming it here.
I know.
In this part, because he's such a good actor. And, you know, anything he's ever in, he's one of those guys who kind of makes it a little bit better, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, but I don't, you know, this part, I mean, again, it's not that it's a bad movie. It's just ridiculous, you know, and
yes.
This whole last half about the, you know, the Satanist and the, you know, and all this, it's just silly. I mean, but it is what it is, you know, so you kind of just learn to accept this stuff because the Warrens are around, you know, and so.
Yeah, it really starts going through a lot and unwinding. A lot.
Yeah, it really does.
You know, it's just the easiest way to say it.
The cliff over the quarry, and it's a lot. There's a lot going on here.
Yes.
And Ed's multiple attempts to kill Lorraine. Those are my favorite parts. You know, it's like, yeah, sure. I'm sure that's all. Especially then when we know the rest of the story.
Right.
When we hear the real story, you're thinking, huh. you know, was this somebody writing this in to, you know, kind of make a little plug here?
Yeah, it's a little Easter egg
to real life stuff. I don't know, man.
Right. Right. But, you know, then it's all, it all gets tied up. Like, what'd you say? If only real life could be so neatly tied up with the bow. But that's just not how it goes. I mean, I like the movie. You should definitely check it out. I think all of them are on HBO Max, at least right now. That's where I've been checking them out.
Yeah. I'm sure this one's there too. I mean, I own it. So that's, I just watched my copy because I own number one and number three.
Right. You wouldn't own.
I do not own number two because I hate it too much, but I do own the other two. So.
Oh man. Well, is there any other stuff you want to talk about with the movie, or should we talk about the real story? Because we could
talk. I mean, it's going to end up going back and forth, but we can talk about the real story, you know, or, you know, whatever version of the real story you want to believe, because, you know, Debbie tells and Arnie tell one story and the kid who's actually possessed tells a whole different story. He and his brother. So it's a bit of a division there in the family, I think.
Right, right. And then I guess you talk a little bit, we've talked about the Satanic Panic before, but this has got to, I mean, this just, in any other time that this kind of thing happens, if it's a Satanic Panic, well, not going was, on.
Yes, this was the perfect time for that to happen. If you were going to get away with the Devil Made Me Do It defense, it's going to be in the early 80s. I mean, it just is. Because
that would have been the time.
This was such a, I mean, it was such a widespread belief that, you know, the devil was, you know, alive and well and working through, you know, American everything. You know, it was in our books and our TV shows and our records. And when you play them backwards, and we talked about all that, so people have a good idea of what that's all about. But this was a great time. You know, you're coming in on the heels of, you know, The Exorcist and the Amityville Horror, which of course had the Warren's fingerprints all over it. And then you get into this particular story and, you know, again, it's this New England thing. And I don't know, I always laugh and say, you know, the New England people, the demons are everywhere. But honestly, I just think it's the Warrens. I think they're to blame for everyone in New England, you know, short of the Salem witch trials, you know, believing that there are demons everywhere, because I think they got most of their publicity in that area. You know, I think that's where they were best known, you know?
Right. Well, when you mentioned, I had some notes here, but pretty much trying to go with a possession defense or whatever. And then it said, you know, the agent insured X, Y, and Z and all that sort of thing. In my eyes, I would have probably, if I were the Warrens, I'd be like, oh, hell yeah, let's go for this. We're about to make a ton of money.
Yeah, well, I am sure that's exactly what they thought, too. And unfortunately, that's kind of where the story, you get all these details about this exorcism and everything. And you never, but one thing you never hear about is, so if Arnie was possessed when he murdered this guy, is he still possessed? Because nobody ever did anything about it.
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of. So, I mean, we're still blaming this demon on Arnie killing this guy. But yet when the judge said, no, we're not letting that in. There's no proof of anything like, there's no evidence of anything like that. We can't let that in as a defense. No one talked about it anymore. So what's the deal with Arnie? I mean, whatever happened to him? I mean, as far as demons go, I know what happened to him, but as far as demons go.
Didn't you mention that somebody, maybe it was Lorraine, said that Arnie now knows how to
Ed knows how to fight it off. So we're assuming that he got rid of it, but there's no, in real life, there's no way, we see it in the movie, but there's, because of course they killed the, you know, the Satanist and the curse goes away. But in this particular, in real life anyway, if we're supposed to believe that this really happened, they just kind of just let it go and everybody stopped talking about it. So
that's funny, because when I read that, I didn't ask that same question that you did. But in my head, I was like, okay, so they just taught him that it's still in him, but now he just knows how to fight it back.
Like, yeah, like you're fighting off a seizure. And that's really not even how he phrased it. He says,
yeah.
Well, Arnie gets what happened now. Now he knows if something like that happens, he knows how to ward it off, and he won't be stupid enough to take on the devil again. That's
right.
Why
okay,
Dad
yes.
ended Ed was that stupid for the rest of his life.
Yes, yes.
Allegedly.
yeah, we have to say allegedly.
No, well, you don't have to say anything because he's dead.
Oh, right.
Allegedly, he did this his entire life. But my thoughts on that are, questionable.
Well, with how defamation goes, I don't know. I don't want to mess with their estate that they might still have.
Can't libel the dead. So
I like how you talk about the real story. David keeps seeing an old man threatening to take his soul. And I like how it keeps going. It's like, damn, if I really wanted to get out of some cleaning work like that, it's like,
that's the way to do it, man. That's the way to do it. I'm just telling you, this old man, I think he wants my soul. I'm not going to be able to rake these leaves today. So I'm going to let you go.
Yeah.
I'll be back maybe tomorrow to mow the grass, but I can't promise anything because, this guy might be trying to steal my soul again.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. What do you say to that? What does an average person say to that excuse? And then the visions that were occurring to him during the daytime. This is something that I think about a lot because the movie The Grudge, when Sarah Michelle Gellar, especially when she's on the bus and she looks and sees the reflection during the daytime in the window of the thing
awesome.
Coming, I was like, oh man, you just normally think about nighttime stuff, but
I know
if everything's happening in the daytime, that would
I keep thinking about what a glory time that was in the early 2000s, the 2000s, all those Japanese horror films, some of which I had seen, but most I had not, that were turned into American versions, and how scary The Grudge was.
Yes. So
and Will and The Ring, and they're both still good. I rewatch both of them. I've even watched them now. Rings, that later one was not that great, but The Grudge, that was the updated one, I actually like that. No, it didn't do any business, I don't think. But
oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know why, but it didn't. But there was a fairly recent one that I thought was really good. The curses gets passed on. But anyway. Sorry, side trip there.
No. I
movie side trip. So.
Love that movie too. Well, at one point, 187 million worldwide. That Grudge. I have to look it up more later. But it definitely didn't get talked about enough. For being scary. I mean, lifting up the bed sheets and then the back of the head and the shower. And just,
I know.
So many good
stuff.
Get sidetracked. Another thing I wanted to talk about after Lorraine's saying, we were sitting on a powder keg. You talk about how they claim Arnie got possessed after visiting an old well. I think that's just a great place for a demon to live.
I know. But I don't remember that in the movie.
No,
I don't think they had that. That was just in the alleged real story.
Yeah.
I guess it was like, how do we explain him going to a well in the movie? In real life, you don't really need an explanation. You just go, well, that's just weird shit happened. But in the movie, there would have had to have been some plot point and there wasn't any mention of a well. So they left that out. But
I just think it was a really cool place for if a demon.
Well, yeah, because
live
why? Because you've seen The Ring. That's why.
That's probably why.
And so old wells are now scary.
That's true. Well, I think even before The Ring, we found a well on the Brockus's farm property. That was in this scary.
They're always creepy.
Little shit. I was like, it's a great place to get murdered.
Yeah. Well, everybody had a well.
Yeah.
I mean, if you grew out, if you grew up in the farm area, there were a bunch of them around where I grew up. I mean, there were. Wells all over the place. And, somebody at one time had thrown some boards over the top of it. And it's like, okay, dude, you don't know. I want to walk on that. So that would be a terrible idea.
Nope.
They are always creepy.
And you always have to have a story.
Plus, I don't know how many historic crime stories that I've written over the years where they find bodies in old wells. So it's just bad. Old wells just seem bad. So
right. And so you've seen the movie, you've gone through a lot of back and forth and everything, but the stuff I didn't know about was a lot about Judith Penny and the legal.
That's the thing. Hardly anybody does. I've talked about the book stuff before. And I've talked about When the lawsuit first came up and Gerald Brittle was talking about, you know, all the stuff that, you know, he knew wasn't true and things, but then he shut up when, you know, the lawsuit got settled, but which I'm sure was part of the plan to settle it. But, you know, the stuff with David and Carl Jr., that actually I had seen that a while back. There was a documentary, one of the shock docs that had come out that was about this case, and they're in it. And they are talking about the fact that they not only do they not was David never possessed, but that the Warrens took advantage of his mental health issues. And actually, he has a pretty it's a little convoluted, so I didn't try to explain it all. Mm-hmm. But if you watch the documentary, he talks about a medication that his brother was taking that he believes was the cause of what happened, the things that happened. And, you know, I don't think there's any clear explanation as to why one half of the family is convinced, you know, that he was possessed and the other half just says, no, this didn't happen. I don't know. I don't know what the division there is. So I think that that might play a part. And, you know, there may be some things going on there that we don't know about, you know, family issues that might explain some of that too. But yeah, getting into all the legal stuff, I know that I kind of waded into a hole there talking, but I felt like it was important, even though the demonologist is what Brittle sued over. He wrote that too. And that I think played a big part in this whole mess because the devil in Connecticut was also something that had to be dealt with this stuff. And, you know, there are a lot of problems with the story. And I wonder what would have happened if it had gone to trial, if it hadn't have been settled, because, you know, there was that question as to, well, if these are true stories, then that means they can't be copyrighted because it's history. But if they're made up, which is what he claimed, then that makes them fictional and that puts the studio in a bind.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow they I don't know what happened to settle it, other than according to Brittle, he wasn't the one who was spearheading the lawsuit.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and that's when things get murky. You know, as I don't know exactly. I don't know the details. I only know what was reported. You know, I know what the Hollywood Reporter said about what happened. And according to them, this producer from The Conjuring, who was having his own battles with Warner Brothers and New Line and probably James Wan's company too.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly he was the one controlling the litigation, but according to him, they weren't controlling it, but it was, they had to, because they had bought life rights from Gerald Brittle. Mm-hmm. Allegedly, they were obligated to provide him with an attorney. And I don't know about any of that. I don't know. What I do know is what came out of it. And what came out of it were all these statements from Judith Penny about what had gone on when she was starting at the age of 15 and for the next 4 years, what was happening between her and Ed and by extension, Lorraine. Yeah. Now, again, we have her word on this. Now, she did give, you know, legal depositions here. So, I mean, she could go. I mean, technically, if somebody decided to enforce it, she could go to jail if she lied. Mm-hmm. Technically, I don't know if she did or not. But what reason would she have to lie, considering that she's never asked for a dime? She never sued. She never sold her story. This all came up because this producer had pushed this, you know, lawsuit, and part of the discovery was talking to her, and she, you know, admitted to whatever happened here. So it's a really weird thing. Like I said, Lorraine always denied it, but then they do point out, Hollywood Reporter points out to these weird things that she had, these restrictions she had added into their contract. You know, this is a little odd. I had seen a quote from a entertainment attorney who said they had never seen wording quite like that before.
Interesting.
In a contract
about the prostitution and
any kind of crime,
marriage,
sex with minors, child pornography, you know, sexual assault, or an extramarital sexual relationship, which seems very specific.
But the lady doth protest too
again,
much.
Whatever, you know, according to this lawyer, they hadn't seen anything quite like it, but it is one of the reasons that I've got a problem with them.
And very fair.
Yeah. When I think about, you know, and then you read and you see some of the statements that, that Judith Penny made about how, you know, she's, why did I screw up my life like this? Why did I do this? Mm. Well, that's exactly what a predator would want you to think, that it was your fault, you know, and the fact that, you know, she was taken down to the jail to try to get her to admit it and she wouldn't. And then you've got Ed driving her back and forth to her, you know, court mandated, you know, probation, essentially. And it's like, you know, that's exactly what, if someone was doing that, that's the way they would want her to feel.
Olivia Benson would have nipped this
Have had it. Had
his
field
ass.
Day with this. That's right. Yeah. Yes. He would have never gotten around to calling himself a demonologist because he'd already been in jail.
So. Self-taught demonologist.
But, you know, it was you go back to that. It was a different time. Does it make it right? Obviously. But I understand that it was a different time and things like that weren't often prosecuted the way they are now.
Mm-hmm.
But still, that has done nothing to endear them to me.
Still, so, what the hell, guys? Oh, man. It takes me back to my days at CinemaBlend learning about lawsuits with different studios and things like that and mm-hmm. copyrights and just rights for this and that. And it can get, I mean, law already is super complicated and this entertainment law can get, you know, just as complicated.
Very complicated.
And it also reminds me now of why the Warrens and others maybe sometimes would have to like double down on their stories are true or sometimes that their stories aren't true. You know,
I know.
Go either way to get around this or that or the other thing. And it's just, that's when the truth gets muddled even more so. And just who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. But anyway, interesting story. The first half of it, fun movie for what it is. Just be sure to separate it from real life.
Yeah.
I mean, as that attorney said at the end of my, my article, my monologue, whatever, said, you know, there's a giant sense of take some of this with a big grain of salt to the whole project. And I'm like, yeah, that's what we've been saying all along. So you're right on the money with that one.
Yep.
So.
Why haven't we been given like our like Letterboxd like score, like star ratings of these movies? I didn't think to like,
I didn't do it. I only usually do those on the new stuff.
Out.
So
yeah, that makes sense.
I haven't really been doing it for the older stuff. I watch plenty of things that have been out for a while, but I don't put them in the reviews. I just put the new stuff.
Fair enough.
Which I did give my first, or is it my second? Well, I gave a 4.5 star review to Sinners, which is phenomenal. It is the best movie I've seen this year, honestly.
I saw it in theaters on Saturday.
Best movie I've seen this year.
It's by,
and there's some good stuff coming still. This is going to be a good year for
horror
films.
There's a lot of good horror
stuff.
A lot
of great stuff coming. So,
I saw Sinners in theater. It was the first movie I've seen in theaters in months. And,
so good.
I really, really enjoyed it. I think I'm right at 4.5 too. I need to think more about it. But it's great.
As far as horror films go, I also love The Accountant Part 2, but I've been a fan of the first one for so long that, you know, for years since I first saw it. And so the second one was very entertaining. So.
Right.
Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, also if you're
Until Dawn, however, not so much.
Not so much. Okay, good to know.
Just okay. But yeah, as which I'll probably never talk about it again because it doesn't even rank anywhere that in my listings. It's not terrible. It's just not really that great. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it was a video game until right before I went to see it. I had no idea. Right. And normally that doesn't turn me off because there are plenty of movies that I really enjoyed that were made from video games or like The Last of Us TV shows, you know, but this one really felt like a video game. Plus, there was this really weird time adjustment thing where they actually used this trope where they went, wow, I can't remember the last 10 days.
But look, I have all these videos on my phone. I'm like, are you kidding me? That is the laziest thing I have ever seen. So, yeah, that one kind of bored me. But anyway, Sinners, on the other hand, absolutely go see it.
Yep. So. Yep. If you're an okay fan of horror, but you are a fan of music.
Absolutely. And please tell me that you read my note and did not get up when the credits started.
I did. So we were sitting there and I was good. Like, I feel like Troy said to not get up.
Not get up. Yeah. Because there is like 30 seconds of credits and then there's like another 10 minutes of movie with a whole other scene that puts the whole rest of the movie in a different light.
Yeah.
Plus you get to see Buddy Guy
playing
the old version of the young kid from this. I just love this movie. Yeah. It was so good. I can't wait. As soon as it comes out on VOD, I'm watching it again at home.
Nice.
So good. So anyway.
That's awesome. Yeah. Is there anything else we want to talk about with?
I think we're good. We've got one more week of the Warrens and then we're going to be done. And then I think I really can't say never again. But we're going to do one more that it's not part of the series, the Conjuring series. We got one more episode coming. So Bob, with your text, this is jumping the gun on the haunt line, but Bob wanted to know if we were going to do an episode on that particular film. He says, I haven't seen the movie, but I've seen a bunch of shows about the house in Connecticut that supposedly had a portal of hell in the basement or something like that. Well, it is a haunting in Connecticut, and we will be covering that in our next episode. I know I haven't been giving away what we'd be talking about, but I thought it was pretty obvious.
Yeah, it's
The three Conjuring movies, and that this is the last one we're going to talk about, though, because after that, I can't do anymore. Yeah. Actually, I'm not even sure I'm going to do any more after this whole legal mess thing, but we will. Anyway, we're going to cover one more, and then we'll be done. Even though there is another film that is based on the Smurl haunting that the Warrens were involved in. And it was a television made for TV movie too. And it has different people playing the Warrens and it's, also not good, but it's not good. But better. It's not as good as the Andy Griffith, Kevin Bacon one. And I know we didn't really talk about that, but you've got to
check it out.
If you get a chance, you got to watch it. It's on YouTube and it is the demon murder case. And it is exactly what you want it to be from a 1980s made for TV movie. But really, the cast is pretty darn good. That's the thing. You know, I mean, Andy Griffith. Well, they also toned down the Warren's role in the whole thing quite a bit, honestly. But They've also got there's quite a few people in it besides Kevin Bacon. Mm-hmm. Cloris Leachman is in it,
like
a reporter.
Nice.
She doesn't have a huge role, but still, you know, and there's a lot of faces you'll recognize from like 80s movies and TV. So anyway, worth taking a shot. I mean, what the hell? It's free. It's on YouTube. So you can watch the whole thing on there. So anyway. All right. Well, enough of that.
Hey,
so.
No, it's all good. I did get a couple emails come in, but they were mostly really long ones, positive things. So I don't have any Ghostwriter stuff this week. But
you can condense those a little bit if you're worried about it.
Yeah, you know? A lot of it was a lot of personal stuff.
But you're right. But you could leave in some of this stuff.
Sure, you're right.
Just trying to be helpful. I don't put every message from, you know, that we get on the haunt line in. Sometimes I'll cut something out if it's too much, or I just answer them sometimes if they're more personal than, you know.
Right. And I'll do that.
Or if they're just something nice, I just say thanks.
I don't want to censor our audience.
I'm not seeing that.
I know.
Anyway, go ahead.
I know.
Sorry.
So I wanted to move on to the haunt line, but before I forget, I did want to say I did pitch the Broxes earlier today. We were talking about the Satanic Panic because of this episode. I did pitch them on the Santanic Panic, all about that that summer with Rob Thomas and that smooth song that came out and took over the radio.
Santanic Panic. That's pretty good.
Thank
you. That is good. That was the revival of Santana's career, man.
Right?
Yeah. And then I just saw him like get like helped off stage the other day.
Oh, really?
The guy's got getting up there, but man. I mean, yeah, I think he had something got sick or something. I just saw him, which is too bad. He seems like a cool dude.
Yeah. So.
Well, and actually, I do like, actually, that's a good album. So thank I know we can it. Make fun of it, but it's a good album.
Thank
so,
you. All right.
It's still good. Every song on it's pretty good. So
nice. I got one. Yeah. Got one past you. All right.
Yeah, but that was a good one. So, okay. All right. Yeah. All right. Guys, so if you you can email Cody, as he mentioned, I don't think he told you where, but if you have a question you'd like to have answered, you can email Cody at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Or you can text us on the haunt line, which is 217-791-7859. And it might, just might, get read on the show. So I do have a few, not too many, but I do have a few. The first one comes from, oh no, I can't read all of this, but I can read some of it. But it comes from Kendall in the 507. I'm a huge fan of the podcast and all that American Hauntings does. What are your thoughts or knowledge of Robert the Doll and the curse? And then it also wants to know who's a bigger fraud. And it lists the Warrens and it lists some other people too. But I'm just going to leave it at, I don't know why it's a competition. They can all be frauds.
There you go.
But as far as Robert the Doll goes, that if you're not familiar with the story, it is about a doll in Key West, Florida that was a childhood doll of an artist when he was a boy who grew up there in Key West. And the doll is alleged to be cursed today. It is kept out at the old fort. In a glass case. And when people go out there and to see it, you're supposed to ask him permission before you take his picture and all this stuff. I'm sure most people are familiar with this. I enjoy the doll or I enjoy the Robert story because it's a Key West story and I like Key West. And I've seen him probably half dozen times. I've taken his picture every time. I've never once asked for his permission.
I
don't know. It's just, it's fun. I mean, I will say that, and I'm not going to name any names as far as the company goes, but I will say I went there for a ghost tour once because that was at the time, that was the only way to see Robert. And I had gone there for a ghost tour and the whole tour, I mean, it was fine. It was a decent tour. It was on a trolley and we went out to the fort and we went to see Robert. We went in and everybody went in, they handed them out these, you know, very inexpensive EMF detectors, you know, that pick up literally everything because these things were not meant to pick up ghosts. It's not that we were made to do. It was for electrical stuff. So that's essentially what they're carrying around. And so they walk in and then the guide had already kind of, prime them with the idea that if you get near Robert, your EMF detector is going to go off. And of course, everyone's did. And there's a lot of oohs and ahs. And he had tried to hand me one and I passed. I'm like, it's okay. You know, I was nice about it. But anyway, so we went in. And so then I just kind of looked and there's electrical cables.
Yes.
That have purposely been run all over the place.
Yes.
For the tourists. So I don't think there's anything to it, but he's still cool and he's still creepy looking, you know.
Creepy as hell.
I do have a stuffed version of Robert here in my office. He's sitting in a rocking chair with his stuffed toy.
Is he in a little sailor outfit?
He is in a little sailor outfit and he's just a fun little guy to have around. So anyway, so this one comes to us from Justin in the 618. I was thrilled to hear my review read on the podcast. This week hasn't been the best, but hearing it made my day. So I wanted to make sure that I read that for you. So, but thanks, Justin. And we appreciated the review as well. So this one's my favorite one. This one comes from the 217 and it says, I'm finishing the last episode about the Enfield poltergeist. When you compared the nun to Ewoks, I cracked up. I disagree, but it was great. Now, here's the big question. If you accept Chewbacca, why don't you think the Ewoks don't belong? Well, I could tell you that. I could tell you that in a half an hour, or I can tell it to you in a couple of minutes.
Uh-huh.
Chewbacca is an actual character. Chewbacca was not dreamed up to just sell toys like the Ewoks were. And here's the evidence of that. When Chewbacca was featured in the original Star Wars, before we called it The New Hope or whatever that one is, when it was just Star Wars, no one had any idea that anyone would go see this cheap ass space opera movie. No one knew. It was a brilliant idea from the guy who had done American Graffiti. The studio had no faith in it whatsoever. They put it out there and it became a blockbuster. And no toys of any kind, no marketing materials of any kind were made prior to Christmas of 1977, even though the movie came out in the summer, because it caught everybody off guard. It became too popular, too fast, and they weren't prepared. Nothing started coming out as far as toys and things went until the following spring. So that's when all the toys came along. So Chewbacca was never intended to be a toy. Sure, he became one, but he wasn't created for that purpose. The Ewoks, on the other hand, by the time the third movie came out, they were toys. They were meant to be toys. They were a marketing opportunity, and I hate them. I absolutely hate them. I don't have anything against teddy bears. I don't have anything against bears. I don't have anything against hairy cannibals like they are, but I hate the Ewoks. So there you go. I'm sorry, but you're never going to convince me to like them. So,
I just got a new Darth Vader graphic novel, and it's pretty epic. So
really?
It's cool. A lot of the stories that, yeah, but just the untold kind of, what are they called?
Got around to watching Andor, and it took me a while to get into the first season. It wasn't until like episode 8. I kept dogging through it, and I kept telling Sam and my friend Trey that runs the museum, like, he's been begging me to watch it for all this, you know, it's an adult Star Wars. I'm like, okay, so's The Empire Strikes Back, but okay. Anyway, so he's telling me this, and I'm like, God, this is so boring. Mm-hmm. Is anything going to happen? And then finally it does. So now I'm kind of jazzed for season.
Okay, all right, cool.
Yeah, so now I'm into it. It just took a little while to get into it, but I am enjoying it. So, all right, so anyway, this is our last one. This is from Katie. She is not in the 217, but her phone number is, because she says, big fan from Chicago. I like this season. You guys are just stating facts because we're having trouble with these Conjuring things, especially the Conjuring episodes. I never skip your conversations post-episode topic either. Would love more Chicago and Illinois content in the future, and I imagine that we'll get there. So keep it up, dudes. And that comes from Katie. So
sweet.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks, Katie.
So, all right. Well, that's it for this week. So if you guys are interested in sending us a quick question or review or anything else that you want to comment on, you can send it to the hotline. It's 217-791-7859, and it might get read on the show.
Sorry, there was a motorcycle outside.
Oh, I'm like, what is he doing? You guys couldn't see it, obviously, but I just wondered what was going on. So. And now I know. So,
all right. Boy, sorry, is that to me now? I was just listening to the Harleys outside.
Yeah, no, I was talking about you, and I was talking about you to everyone else. So anyway, so we good? We're going to wrap this baby up?
Yep.
All right. So guys, thanks again for checking out the story and the postmortem for this week's episode. We hope you love the show. And if you do, we hope you'll share it with your friends, family, strangers, or just people you meet on the street. Encourage them to listen. And if you get a chance, we hope you go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review, even if you don't listen that way. And if you do leave a review, we'll be reading at least one of them during the postmortem each time. And if we read yours, we'll send you something cool in the mail. Also helps if you check your iTunes, if that's how you listen, make sure that we are set to automatically download to your feed. That way you never miss a show and it helps us out. And we even reward you for doing that. We have a discount code you can use to get 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from American Hauntings. Just use the code PODCAST at checkout. Save a few bucks on whatever you buy because American Hauntings is more than just a podcast. It's also books, tours, ghost hunts, events, the Haunted America Conference, the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois, and a whole bunch of stuff I either can't remember or just don't have time to list. So thanks, and you can find everything about us on the website at AmericanHauntings.net, except for I don't think you can find our Patreon, which I don't think we mentioned where to get to that. So if you want to become a Patreon supporter and get our alternative podcast, of which I just finished writing another episode today, you can go to patreon.com/AmericanHauntings.
Awesome. Well, this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor, and it was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck.
To find out more about the show, check out the show notes or go to our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. If you want to find out more about the podcast, you can reach us via email, by text on the hotline, or on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, and probably other places on social media that I just don't care about right now. Thanks again.
I don't care about half those, so...
You know where to find us.
Yeah, that's right. We're out there.
Thanks again for listening. We couldn't, definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
We'll see you later.
I was trying. I hate having to cut out parts of the combo because I can never remember where. So I was trying to cover the mic so it wouldn't do the motorcycle.
What is he doing? I was just so distracted.
I was hoping
I don't
he wouldn't
know
look.
What I said, but I was like, what is he doing? I was hoping you wouldn't look at me at that.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.